Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a while since the last installment of Admiral Cunningham's life story, so let's fix that as we rejoin him at the start of 1941, and brace yourselves, it's a little bit of a roller coaster. Now, it's fair to say that the Mediterranean Fleet started 1941 on a bit of a high. Regimarina activity, by their capital units at least as a whole, was down thanks to the recent attack on Taranto, and letters from home indicated that the Germans appeared to have given up on the invasion of Britain aspect of their plans, and they'd instead switched to just bombing cities randomly. Whilst this obviously wasn't very good for the cities, it did at least mean that it was unlikely that panzers would soon be trying to land on the Dover beaches, at least any time soon. However, more generally, the situation was not quite so brilliant. Thus far, the Royal Navy was down a battleship, the Royal Oak, two carriers, Courageous and Glorious, three cruisers, 38 destroyers, and 23 submarines. Against that, since the war started, King George V had come online, as had Illustrious and Formidable, and the cruisers Dido, Phoebe, Bonaventure, Naiad, Fiji, Nigeria, and Kenya had all commissioned. But only nine new destroyers had entered service. 11 if you count two that had been built for the Royal Australian Navy, along with 18 submarines. Which meant that hull-wise, at the upper end, the Royal Navy was treading water, and as you went further down, it was well down on numbers in pretty much every department, with the exception of cruisers, and regardless of individual hull capabilities, a ship could only ever be in one place at a time. With the fall of France and the occupation of Norway, the Royal Navy's responsibilities now stretched far, far further than pre-war planning had envisaged, and overall, they had fewer hulls with which to fulfil these missions. But, as said, in the Mediterranean, things did seem to be looking up a bit. Not only was the Regimarina on the back foot, but the Royal Navy had been asked to support the army in its assault on Bardia on the 3rd of January, and so the land campaign seemed to be going quite well. Thus, at 0800 that morning, Warspite, Barham and Valiant opened up with a hail of 15-inch gunfire on the beleaguered Italians, with Illustrious providing air cover and spotting services. The only slight disappointment of the day was that some old 15-inch shrapnel shells, a legacy of the Dardanelles campaign from World War I, had been dug up from somewhere in Malta, and it turned out that, well, they were somewhat unreliable after almost three decades in storage, and so regular high explosive would have to do for most of the bombardment. After spending most of the day re-landscaping the coastline, the fleet headed home, leaving the monitor Terror and the gunboats Aphis and Ladybird to keep up harassing fire. 2 days later, Australian troops would complete the capture of the slightly cratered Bardia. The reason for spending just a day in supporting fire for the army was that on the 7th of January the fleet was needed for Operation Excess, a complicated convoy run that would start in the Western Mediterranean under the cover of Force H, and the convoy would be handed over to the Mediterranean fleet midway through the Mediterranean. Now, assuming the relevant merchant ships survived, the plan was for one large freighter to take ammunition and supplies to Malta, an oiler would head for Souda Bay in Crete to service the Royal Navy ships there, three other ships would break away with supplies for the embattled Greek forces, and finally, other ships with mixed supplies would head for Alexandria. Additionally, the Mediterranean Fleet ships would be taking soldiers and air crew to Malta on their way west to pick up the convoy, and they would be accompanied by some supply ships from Alexandria, which would also head for Malta with the escort forces, and merchant ships currently trapped in Malta would head back out. Cunningham had arranged for his sea cabin and bathroom to be located one level down from the bridge of Warspite, so he was always available on call if needed. From his perspective, the main operation started pretty well, with bombers dissuading the remaining Italian capital ships from coming too close on the 8th, and the troop support the Mediterranean Fleet's warships were successfully landed in Malta. Then, on the 10th, the cruiser Bonaventure and the destroyer Hereward managed to drive off a pair of speaker-class large torpedo boats, or small destroyers, which tried to attack the convoy, sinking one of them. But then, it all started to go a little bit pear-shaped. The destroyer Gallant had her bow blown off by a mine, and what was left of the ship had to be towed to Malta under escort. The rest of the fleet followed the convoy as it headed further east. Then, just after lunch, a pair of Italian torpedo bombers appeared. This was something they'd dealt with before. Valiant evaded their torpedoes successfully, but unfortunately, it also meant that the combat air patrol of Fulmars headed down to the deck to deal with the intruders, incidentally managing to shoot them up quite a bit. But there are indications that this is actually exactly what the Axis forces wanted, as no sooner had the fighters reached sea level than a very large force of HE-111s, BF-110s, and, crucially, JU-87s appeared on the horizon at high altitude. This heralded the entry of Fliegerkorp 10 to the Mediterranean theater. There was no time for either the combat air patrol or freshly launched fighters to reach interception altitude. This was exactly the scenario Admiral Henderson had feared when he had been designing the Illustrious class. Now, his theories about whether or not armoured flight decks and armoured sides were better than more aircraft would be put to the test. To give you some idea of scale, now roughly as many dive bombers as would account for three whole Japanese fleet carriers at Midway the following year now focused their sole and undivided attention on poor old Illustrious. For the most part, they were carrying heavier bombs as well. Illustrious vanished amidst the hail of explosions and water spouts. One of the HE-111s dropped a bomb, which just about hit Warspite technically. It was a large bomb, and it actually hit the fluke of the starboard anchor, only partially detonating. Cunningham and the bridge watched with some amusement as a large part of the bomb, which they reckoned to be about the size of the wardroom sofa, promptly sailed back up and over the bridge of the battleship to land in the sea behind them. But as it turned out, Henderson's ideas were proven right. Despite sustaining half a dozen hits from multiple attacks, a combination of Illustrious's armour, her heavy anti-aircraft armament, and the few Fulmars that were airborne, some of which had headed off for nearby Malta, refuelled, rearmed, and come back again, managed to keep the ship afloat, and although she was still actively on fire, she made 17 knots on her way to Malta, where repairs could begin. Their fury expended, the Fliegerkorp 10 pilots could only watch the rest of the Mediterranean fleet, and the convoy itself, sail off into the sunset. Unfortunately, the Germans would get a second bite at the apple. Having seen what was left of the destroyer Gallant to safety, the cruisers Southampton and Gloucester headed east the next day to catch up with the rest of the fleet. And they were caught alone by another wave of JU-87s. Gloucester was hit and damaged, but Southampton was hit repeatedly and set ablaze. When it was clear that there would be no saving her, the survivors would be evacuated, and Gloucester sent her sister ship to the seabed with a torpedo. The Luftwaffe now spent most of the rest of the month trying to finish off Illustrious at Malta, which wasn't pleasant for the locals, but it was probably actually the least worst outcome, as it meant the dive bombers largely ignored the freighter Essex, which had made it into the Grand Harbour with a wide variety of supplies, but was at that moment still loaded with 4,000 tons of ammunition, which would have made a bit of a mess of everything in the Grand Harbour, including Illustrious, had the freighter taken a hit to the cargo holds. However, it was quite clear that if the carrier hung around, it was only a matter of time before the Germans eventually finished the job, and so on the 23rd of January she made a successful break for Alexandria, arriving 2 days later, and then waiting to head via the Suez Canal for repairs, with her place due to be taken by her sister ship Formidable, which was on its way around Africa from the South Atlantic. But since the Illustrious would be out of action for quite a while, her aircraft were distributed between Malta and Crete. The Fulmars would assist in air defence, while the Swordfish would look to extract a measure of revenge for their mothership's pain. The arrival of the Luftwaffe in the Mediterranean set in train a series of ideas that were batted back and forth with London about some kind of operation in the Dodecanese Islands, where long-range German bombers were now based and were now occasionally trying to close the Suez Canal. But by the end of the month, the Australians, with the help from the Terror and the so-called Scrap Iron Flotilla of the Royal Australian Navy, had managed to take Tobruk, which was being rapidly prepared as a resupply port for the army ashore. A rather fun interlude now occurred when Mrs. Cunningham told Captain Waller of HMAS Stuart that she and other sailors' wives back in Alexandria were doing their level best to make clothes, especially warm woolen, since it was wintertime, for the men of the fleet. But they were somewhat hampered by a lack of sewing machines. And somehow, she'd heard that there were some sewing machines to be found in Tobruk. A few days later, a lorry with several crates loaded with sewing machines turned up at the Cunningham residence, courtesy of the Royal Australian Navy, coincidentally a few hours after Stuart had returned from a visit to Tobruk. Running supplies to the front lines was made somewhat easier by the fact the Mediterranean fleet now had three older C-class cruisers which had been converted to anti-aircraft ships, plus the Dido-class Bonaventure, although she had to be careful with ammunition expenditure as her 5.25-inch guns were the only ones of their kind in the Mediterranean fleet, and further stocks had yet to arrive. But her modern radar suite made her a very useful escort along with other ships, as she could still function as the eyes of an escorting formation even if her heavy anti-aircraft fire was limited. Benghazi fell to the Allied forces at the start of February, but now that port needed to be cleared and prepared to receive shipping. Now, although the rapid advancement of the Allied armies and the surrender of the Italian 10th Army were welcome developments, it did make the fleet's life a bit more difficult, as Benghazi was quite close to enemy airfields and quite far from Allied ones, which meant that a combination of airdropped mines and direct bomb attacks gradually began to whittle away at the escort forces. A minesweeper, two trawlers, and the faithful old monitor Terror, along with the destroyer Dainty, all ended up being sunk in their efforts to get supplies to and from Benghazi before the month was out. Meanwhile, back in Alexandria, there was an ongoing competition between the Luftwaffe, who kept dropping magnetic mines into the Suez Canal, and the Royal Navy, who were trying to keep the canal clear. This was especially important at this stage, as Illustrious and Eagle were waiting for safe passage to head off for repairs, and Formidable was on the other side, waiting to join the action, but they had to be absolutely sure the canal was clear because nobody wanted an entire aircraft carrier stuck in the middle of it. It would thus be mid-March before the carrier swap could be accomplished. This would all take place amidst a backdrop of London deciding to pause the so far highly successful desert war and instead redirect most of the troops and their equipment to Greece, which would in turn require a lot of transports and thus a lot of escort missions by the Navy. With the RAF equally stretched between trying to defend Malta, Egypt, the newly taken parts of North Africa, and now Crete and Greece, air cover from that source was scarce to say the least, and combined with the threat of the Luftwaffe, Formidable had to rebalance her air group to a more heavily fighter-based one, which in turn meant her striking capacity would be somewhat diminished. Cunningham was very clear in a letter sent back to the First Sea Lord that it seemed that London thought the theatre was vastly better equipped with anti-aircraft guns and fighters than it actually was, along with pretty much all other sorts of military equipment. The anti-aircraft cruisers were really earning their keep by keeping the convoys to Greece mostly safe, but they were suffering wear, tear, and battle damage as a result. The end of March saw yet another attempt to build a heavy cruiser force in the Mediterranean thwarted when HMS York was sunk at Suda Bay by Italian MAS boats which had been refitted as explosive-laden projectiles, with the men driving them bailing out a few hundred yards short of their target. Although York technically wasn't sunk by the attack, merely heavily damaged, subsequent events meant that she never actually moved from that berth again. But as the last days of March closed in, the fleet would manage to score a singular success at the Battle of Cape Matapan, which all began with the spotting of an Italian cruiser squadron by a floatplane. Or at least that was the official story. In actual fact, British codebreakers had established a major force centred on the battleship Vittorio Veneto was at sea and heading to intercept the Greek-bound convoys. The recon aircraft had been dispatched directly into their path to give plausible cover as to why the Mediterranean fleet was now sailing to intercept them. To ensure enemy spies didn't report the fleet's departure, sailing was actually held until after dark, with Cunningham making a great pretense of playing golf all afternoon, as the Japanese consul was suspected of being the main spy in Alexandria, and he was known to also spend the afternoon playing golf. And so, seeing Cunningham, he would presumably think that there was no plans for the fleet to sail anytime soon. Now, as I've already done a video on the Battle of Cape Matapan, there isn't much reason to repeat it in detail here, but suffice to say in summary that it all started as many Mediterranean fights would, with British light cruisers running into Italian forces, then being chased off by Italian heavy cruisers, and then when the Italians seemed to break off, the British pursued in turn, only to encounter Vittorio Veneto in this particular case, and then have to leg it for cover of their own battleships. Then there would be a series of air attacks by torpedo bombers and fulmars from the Formidable, plus some of Illustrious's leftover swordfish based in Crete. And these conspired to hit Vittorio Veneto and then, sometime later, the cruiser Pola. Both stopped dead in the water as a result of their hits, but the Italian battleship had been hit in the stern and had been hit several hours earlier, so she managed to patch herself up enough to make a run for home, whereas Pola was more badly damaged by a hit amidships, and she'd been hit much later just as the sun set. Having seen the last of the British surface ships as a bunch of light cruisers running for their lives, the Italians didn't think they'd be back anytime soon, and so two of Pola's sister ships were sent back to help their compatriot. During the night, radar aboard the British battleships spotted the Italian ships incoming, and with the help of said radar guiding them in, as well as Prince Philip operating HMS Valiant searchlights, the two active Zara-class cruisers were sunk at short range by 15-inch gunfire, with a helping hand from Formidable's 4.5-inch battery before she acknowledged the order to sheer out of line for safety. The Pola would be finished off later, after her surviving crew were mostly rescued. The British cruiser formation almost caught up to the limping Vittorio Veneto as well, but events conspired such that they just missed that interception. With daylight soon to come, and Luftwaffe aircraft circling, the fleet headed for home, signalling the Italians as to where they could find the rest of the survivors that they hadn't had time to pick up. Thus came April, and with it a continuation of mixed fortunes, although they were decidedly turning in the Axis's favour. Allied offensives against Italian colonies in East Africa were going fairly well, and the escort of convoys to Greece had been overall successful, although the cruiser Bonaventure would soon be torpedoed and sunk, which deprived the fleet of both her radar suite and her 5.25-inch guns. But in North Africa, the newly arrived Africa Corps was making short work of sending the skeleton force left in the area into full retreat. By April the 11th, the Axis was back at Tobruk and had surrounded it, and the Germans were also starting their own campaign into Greece. This situation wasn't helped by the Luftwaffe managing to hit an ammunition ship in Piraeus Harbour, which destroyed the ship, most of the port facilities that the Allies had been using to supply the Greek front, and pretty much everything else the blast wave could reach. To cap it all off, it was pretty obvious that the best way to buy the Allied armies time in North Africa to regroup would be to attack the supply lines from Italy that were keeping the Africa Corps and the newly invigorated Italian army in shape. But that would involve further splitting the Mediterranean fleet's forces. Still, there wasn't much else that could be done, and so a pair of Tribal-class destroyers and a pair of J-class destroyers were sent to Malta to begin these operations. That would lead rapidly to the Battle of the Tarigo convoy, amongst others, which was covered in the second video I did on small cruiser and destroyer actions of World War II. Another scheme was to try and block Tripoli Harbour. Cunningham thought this was a good idea in principle, especially when the old World War I era battleship Centurion was put forward as a candidate for a block ship. But delays in getting her all the way around Africa to Alexandria meant that London instead suggested using the battleship Barham and one of the precious C-class anti-aircraft cruisers instead. Given all the other demands on the fleet, most of which badly needed either battleship or anti-aircraft support or both, Cunningham pushed back with vigour. Eventually, those at home backed off and suggested instead a full fleet bombardment operation, although they also said that any ships that were badly damaged in the course of this operation and thus unable to make it home should be used as impromptu block ships. The plan was to sail for Malta as if they were covering the escape of a number of merchant ships in the Grand Harbour, but then turn and sail for Tripoli as night fell in order to arrive offshore at dawn. with the submarine Truant having gone ahead to act as a fixed range marker from which they could calculate the ranges to various targets on shore, complete surprise was achieved and much damage was inflicted in Tripoli, with opposition being limited to a few scattered shots from shore batteries which took almost half an hour to wake up and which had precious little effect. But no sooner had this been done than another bright spark back in London, or possibly the same one, decided that a battleship was now to be sent to Malta to help attack the Axis supply convoys. This, of course, completely ignored the slow speed of the Mediterranean Fleet's capital ships compared to that of the destroyers used for the task so far, as well as the cruisers that had been potentially earmarked to take part. It also neglected the fact that cruisers and destroyers used vastly less fuel than a battleship did, and fuel oil was not an unlimited resource at Malta. And finally, it would of course also leave the main fleet with just two operational battleships at a time when the Littorio was finally being patched up after Taranto and was making ready to go to sea once again. On top of these issues, the short-lived and disastrous Greek campaign now needed an evacuation put in place, and that would inevitably mean much valuable heavy equipment, not to mention time and lives, had been wasted in effectively handing the Africa Corps much of Libya on a plate. Four mainline cruisers, the three anti-aircraft cruisers, 20 destroyers, three sloops, and a couple of large infantry landing ships were tasked with pulling the Allied forces out of Greece, alongside a number of troop ships and some landing craft, plus a few local small craft that either volunteered or were requisitioned. Because of the dominance of Axis air power, the ships had to lurk offshore during the day, making a dash in during the evening. Then, starting to load up an hour after sunset, they had to be away by 0300, lest roving bombers catch them too close to the shore. Although working in reverse to their design, the Glengyle and Glenerne, the two landing ships, proved invaluable as their plethora of purpose-designed small landing craft were perfect for extracting men in large numbers from the beaches. The risks and the cold calculation of the timing were illustrated when the Dutch transport Slamat waited until 0415 to sail rather than 0300, as the captain didn't want to leave some troops from a unit behind. Although noble in intention, it meant the ship was easily spotted near the coast around dawn, and at 0715 she was bombed and sunk. The destroyers Diamond and Rhynek moved in to rescue survivors, only to be dive-bombed themselves. Carried all the way from the rescue site, both ships would in turn be hit and sunk later in the afternoon, with only 66 men from all three ships' crews and the embarked troops surviving. 983 were lost. Other ships would also be hit and sunk, but generally the evacuation was a success, the mostly well-timed night operations minimising losses in both ships and evacuated men, although several thousand were left behind through simple lack of capacity. Some troops were taken straight back to Alexandria, others were aboard ships which either would take far too long to get all the way back to Egypt, or at the other end of the spectrum were actually fast enough that if they could offload that day, they could speed back for another pickup the following night, and these troops would therefore mostly be dropped off at Crete, which was about to become the new northern front line. April turned into May, and Tobruk, or what was left of it, still held out. Rommel's advance stalled out on the Egyptian border, largely through outrunning its own supply lines, but of course that just made Tobruk an even more vital objective for both sides. The three remaining destroyers that were operating out of Malta were replaced by two J-class and four K-class, which had freshly arrived from the UK, although HMS Jersey hit a mine and sank less than a week after arriving, reducing the force back down to five. This loss was a direct result of the Axis Air Forces having decided to try and mine rather than bomb Malta into submission for a little bit, as mining was now something of a theme for them, with other units dropping aerial mines around Alexandria, and of course, as we've covered, they'd already tried that in the Suez Canal. Although everyone, from Cunningham down to the lowliest rating, was showing signs of stress, there could be no let-up. Although the troops evacuated from Greece that had reached Egypt were welcome in the attempts to hold off Rommel, the heaviest equipment they'd managed to bring back with them was a Bren gun, and so tanks and pretty much every other piece of heavy weaponry were needed, and that meant another run through the Mediterranean with a convoy. although this task was sweetened somewhat by the news that the battleship Queen Elizabeth and the cruisers Naiad and Fiji would accompany the convoy all the way from Gibraltar to Alexandria and then join the Mediterranean fleet. In common with previous operations, supply ships with food, ammunition and fuel for Malta would accompany the Mediterranean fleet as it headed west, and a small force was also detailed to shoot up Benghazi, both on general principle and specifically to disrupt Axis resupply efforts, and also to provide a distraction, as the enemy might believe, when the shells began falling, that another bait-and-switch shore bombardment was about to occur, and thus divert their attention to the wrong place. As the operation began, however, Malta signalled that the Axis forces had dropped so many mines that the ships based there were trapped, and all of their minesweepers had been sunk or damaged. Cunningham now summoned one Commander Kahn, who was a specialist in torpedoes and mines. He went below decks to think, re-emerging sometime later with a rather audacious plan. The fleet had one sloop sailing with them, the Gloxinia, which was outfitted to deal with magnetic mines. He proposed that she would go with the supply ships, but before they got there, the destroyers and bombers at Malta were charged with using depth charges, which were one of the few things in liberal supply on the island, to blast a channel through the mines, on the basis that the shock of a continuous line of depth charges going off would either detonate the mines in the channel they were trying to sweep, or it would at least damage their fuses so they couldn't go off. Any lucky survivors from this attempt, the Gloxinia would deal with. This actually proved remarkably successful, although the sloop did manage to locate almost a dozen mines in the area that the depth charges had been put through, which they'd missed or failed to damage. Elsewhere, the Benghazi attack force encountered a pair of Axis supply ships and destroyed both of them. It turned out that both vessels were loaded with a mixture of vehicles, fuel, and ammunition, and exploded quite readily. The cruiser Ajax later reported watching flaming trucks arcing through the sky over the masts of the nearby destroyers and then landing all around the cruiser. Luck held. Thick, low cloud, almost low enough to be counted as fog, beset the area, and it made the job of Axis aircraft pretty much impossible. The fleet watched as dozens of aircraft appeared on radar, circled around for a bit, and then moved off again. This pattern repeated every few hours as the fleet's mast scraped the low cloud. Sometimes the aircraft were even close enough to hear, but neither side could physically see the other, and so hostilities were not enjoined. Eventually, on May the 10th, as the cloud cleared, the air attacks managed to begin in earnest, but the combined firepower of no less than six anti-aircraft cruisers, the three C-class and now three Didos, plus the Formidable's combat air patrol, and the anti-aircraft firepower of no less than four battleships, which included all three modernised Queen Elizabeths, saw the attacks driven off without incurring any damage to either the warships or the merchant ships. Thus was Operation Tiger considered to be a great success. But of course, what giveth also taketh away, and no sooner had this occurred than the Axis began its assault on Crete. Unfortunately, this came at the worst possible time air cover-wise. Losses suffered in Greece had left the RAF with barely enough to contest the desert skies in North Africa, and thus nowhere near enough to help cover the fleet or Crete in any meaningful way. And wear and tear on Formidable's air group, combined with a lack of resupply for the fleet air-arm aircraft, meant that that ship had but four working aircraft left aboard. Intelligence suggested that the attack date was somewhere between the 15th and 17th of May, and the fleet duly deployed to intercept it, but for various reasons the attacks were delayed somewhat and 4 days of bombing began instead. This meant that a number of the larger fleet elements had to head back to Alexandria to refuel, just in time for the actual assault to begin. Now, there were some bright spots from a naval perspective. Two major attempted landings by sea were thwarted, with a large number of Axis troop transport vessels sunk, and a number of smaller landing attempts were likewise driven off, but in the face of massive enemy aircraft waves and without much in the way of air cover themselves, the fleet had to contend with the Luftwaffe and the Regia Aeronautica, without freedom to manoeuvre, and with ammunition thus gradually running out. Additionally, as Cunningham would later admit, The fact that part of the fleet had had to detach back to Alexandria meant that what was left of the fleet was scattered about, assigned to individual tasks, and thus easier for the Luftwaffe and the Regia Aeronautica to target in detail. Cunningham also noted that they'd already learned the lesson that a mass fleet concentration was far better at driving off air attacks, but orders from London were orders from London, and with the core of the fleet off to refuel, there was precious little else he could do. Even so, while the anti-aircraft ammunition lasted, a satisfying number of enemy aircraft were shot down or damaged, and most of the ships involved were subject to near misses or the occasional hit, but otherwise were doing quite well. But then as ammunition ran low, the anti-aircraft screen began to falter, and more dive bombers began to find their targets. In a period of less than 2 weeks, the cruisers Gloucester, Fiji, and Calcutta were sunk, along with the destroyers Hereward, Juno, Kelly, Greyhound, and Cashmere, plus the destroyer Imperial, damaged beyond all reasonable repair. Formidable, Warspite, Barham, Ajax, Dido, Orion, Carlisle, and Perth were all damaged to one extent or another, as were the destroyers Kelvin and Nubian and the submarine Rover. Survivors reported multiple instances of enemy aircraft strafing survivors in the water. This kind of reprehensible activity continued, unfortunately. The hospital ship Aba, despite being clearly marked, was repeatedly attacked by dive bombers, saved only by the intervention of the anti-aircraft cruiser Coventry, and Coventry herself was attacked for her troubles, which at least drew fire from the hospital ship. Petty officer Sefton, aboard Coventry, would be awarded a posthumous Victoria Cross for his actions. He was shot through by an enemy strafing run, but he propped himself up and continued to direct the anti-aircraft gunners in coordinating their fire, most likely saving both ships through his efforts, refusing to be taken below until the attack was over. He would subsequently die of his wounds the following day. The Battle of Crete rapidly turned into yet another evacuation, and in the middle of all of this, London stuck its oar in again. Cunningham had ordered the landing ship Glenroy to turn back from heading to Crete due to the sheer scale of air attacks involved at the time, but then a direct order from London ordered her to turn back again and head to Crete. Cunningham, by this point, had had quite enough of interference from afar and countermanded the orders directly, instructing the ship to head back for Alexandria and to disregard any and all further radio signals until she got there. He then sent a rather stiff message back to London, informing them that had Glenroy followed their orders, she and the more than 1,000 sailors and soldiers aboard her would not only have arrived in what was about to become a retreat, but she would have done so in broad daylight and thus almost certainly have been blown out of the water. Despite almost every seaborne attempt at landing being repulsed or destroyed, the Germans had managed to feed in enough troops by air to overcome the defenders, who in the aftermath of Greece had little in the way of heavy weapons to oppose them. London continued to be unhelpful, within the same 24-hour period, demanding the Navy surge forward past Crete and into the Aegean, presumably to destroy enemy landing attempts even more than they had already been destroyed, despite the fact that this would move them into short range of Axis airfields and thus allow the Stukas to bring their heaviest bombs to bear, and were also calling for even more troops and even more of the scarce heavy equipment left in the Mediterranean to be landed in Crete, demanding a victory in Crete above all else. And then, as mentioned, within 24 hours, switching the orders around to complete and utter evacuation. A said evacuation got underway with an ever-diminishing number of operational ships. There were about 22,000 Allied troops still on Crete when the evacuation order was given, and as bombs fell and more ships were hit, even the army suggested that perhaps it was time to call off the evacuation in the face of such losses. But Cunningham simply replied, "It takes the Navy 3 years to build a ship. It will take 300 years to build a new tradition. The evacuation will continue." In the end, some 16,500 troops were successfully evacuated, although by the end of it, what had been a mighty Mediterranean fleet was reduced to 5 operational destroyers and 2 battleships. Everything else in their inventory had either been sunk or was now in desperate need of repair. And now, convoy runs to Malta from Alexandria, would be harried almost the entire way, as the Luftwaffe had set up shop on the various airfields present on Crete. A handful of additional stragglers would show up over the next week or so. Three small landing craft, forced to be left behind in the confusion, managed to make their way slowly across the entire southeastern Mediterranean, fetching up ashore with another 250 or so men aboard. One of the landing craft had actually run out of fuel along the way, and thus improvised a sail out of blankets for the last leg. Another 150 men showed up on a small fishing boat that they'd stolen from some Germans, who had arrived ashore late in the battle, but been somewhat less than cautious about securing their conveyance. And to cap it all off, the submarine Thrasher decided to swing by on its way home after a patrol, and found almost 80 more men on the shore, who were also brought home. Inspired by this latter escapade, as well as reports of resistance movements springing up across the island, the fleet submarines were soon engaged in running supplies and special forces to Crete, as well as recovering wounded and regular soldiers back. An operation that has been almost entirely forgotten, but would be ongoing in one form or another for pretty much the rest of the war, and would tie down a disproportionately large amount of Axis troops on Crete. These events left a reduced Mediterranean fleet gradually recovering as the less damaged ships were patched up. They had three primary tasks in their inventory now. They had to keep Tobruk supplied, they had to keep Malta supplied, and they had to keep up attacks on Axis supply convoys. For the first task, that of keeping Tobruk in food, water, and ammunition, as well as night runs by destroyers, a small flotilla of captured Italian schooners were put into service. These craft were very small, sometimes evading notice from enemy aircraft entirely, and when they were attacked, their tiny size meant that aircraft had to get quite close to ensure that they had a chance of hitting them. At which point, the Luftwaffe often discovered that the schooner captains had acquired a disturbingly large number of light anti-aircraft guns from somewhere, and they usually had plenty of enthusiastic troops aboard to help man them. It was still hazardous work. The destroyers Waterhen and Defender would be lost over June and July, along with two sloops sunk and another couple damaged, and with so many enemy air bases on both sides, Crete and the North African coast, and virtually no land or sea-based aircraft left to them, the Allied resupply efforts to Malta would have to mainly come from the west for the moment. Although Cunningham did direct that two mine-laying subs in Alexandria, the Cachalot and Rorqual, could be used to take low-volume but high-value supplies from Alexandria to Malta, using their underwater capabilities to evade air attack. Another task that was thrown Cunningham's way was now supporting the invasion of Syria, as it was feared that with German forces close at hand in Crete, the decidedly pro-German Vichy officers in Syria might allow the Germans to just come in and take over, and that would provide the Axis with a straight shot at the Middle Eastern oil fields, bypassing Egypt completely. Two cruisers and four destroyers were all that could be spared, with a landing ship, another cruiser and two destroyers detailed to make in a dash to land special forces before returning home. This all kicked off in early June, and by early July it was all over, with Syria occupied by the Allies. Fortunately, no ships were lost, although the destroyer Janus was badly damaged when she was engaged by the Vichy destroyers Valmy and Guipard, before they were in turn driven off by the arrival of three more British destroyers. A couple of days later, the destroyers Isis and Ilex were damaged by bombing, and so three more precious destroyers were back in for repairs. As the more heavily damaged ships were patched up enough to make it home or to the US for further repairs, they now began to trickle out via the Suez Canal. A few small reinforcements came the other way, and aside from the Royal Navy submarines suddenly having a lot of fun setting about Axis shipping in the eastern Mediterranean that was now trying to work out how to properly supply all the new locations that had been occupied, the remaining summer months were largely spent recuperating and rearming. A decoy sailing was made to support Operation Substance, a convoy from Gibraltar to resupply Malta, with the Mediterranean fleet making out as if the convoy was in fact a through convoy. This was largely successful in decoying a good number of enemy aircraft away from the actual path of the convoy, which broadly made it successfully in to Malta, and at the same time a number of other ships trapped in Malta's harbour from previous convoys were able to make their way out. The situation on land was pretty much the same. Operation Battle Axe had been repulsed, and no further offensives were possible until the autumn. And so there was a pause in major operations by the Mediterranean fleet. Apart from the aforementioned submarine operations and the continued resupply efforts to Tobruk, until the resumption of land offensive operations in November. And so with that, we'll draw this video to a close. Tune in next time for the continued adventures of Admiral Cunningham and the Mediterranean fleet as Japan enters the war and some annoying Italians show up in Alexandria Harbour.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.